The dickheads are presented in color.
Hey, dickheads, like a pink laser beam of truth beaming from Texas, Ohio, and San Diego to your brain hole. I am your longtime resident dickhead, and joining me, the latest, newest host of the Dickheads podcast, Professor D. Harlan Wilson. And our special guest today is another person who teaches PKD. That's Keith Giles, who's going to be our interview subject for the day for many PKD-related reasons. Keith, welcome to the Dickheads podcast.
Oh, David, thank you so much. And David, thank you so much. good to be here. It's just so you real quick, and I should have told you this before we hit record. It's pronounced Giles.
Giles, David, I'm sorry.
Keith Giles. So that's fine. No big deal. yeah, good to, very, very happy to be here. Love your podcast. Huge Philip K. Dick fan. And it's really great to be able to talk to you guys about my favorite sci-fi author.
Right. Now, we're going to get into your background and a little bit about where you came from. But my first thing first is that a lot of your background is that you're known for having once been a pastor and writing these books about religion. Was it PKD or Serious Religion that came first for you? And what's your origin story?
Oh, no, there you go. What a great way to ask that question. Well, a little bit about the same time, I guess. I mean, you know, it's sort of like I grew up in Texas. Had conservative parents, and big surprise, I became a Southern Baptist, because, you know, what else can you do in Texas? So that's how I kind of got into it. But I think I discovered Philip K. Dick. I think I discovered him probably the way a lot of people do, was like right when Blade Runner came out. And, you know, I was in 1982, right?
Right.
I probably saw it in 83 because I think I saw it on cable. So it was probably a year later I saw it on cable, and it just blew my mind. I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And I was already reading science fiction. I was into like Alan Dean Foster and stuff like that. And I just remember going in, and they had the novel for, you know, Blade Runner, which is of course not the novel of the movie. It's Do I Always Dream of Electric Sheep? And that was the first Philip K. Dick I read. And then I was just like, I want to get everything, my hands on anything this guy wrote. It was just so amazing. So that's kind of when I kind of got into it. The theology thing developed about alongside that. But people know me mainly as an author writing. I just wrote like a 7-part series of books called the Jesus Un series. And each book is dealing with different aspects of theology, basically how screwed up and toxic most of it is, and trying to help people who are trapped in it find their way out of it with their sanity intact. So that's what those books are about.
And you find yourself debating religious figures quite a bit.
Yes. Yes.
Because of those books?
A little bit because of those books. I've done several debates like that online. The one I just did was in Houston with this guy, Dr. James White. I say doctor in quotes because he's technically not really a doctor, but, you know, he plays one. Anyway, so I debated him in Houston on what is biblical marriage. And it was actually really successful. I was very happy with how that went. And yeah, so I kind of get in trouble. It's one of these things where like I'm too sort of progressive for most Christians, and I'm too Christian for most non-Christians. You know what I mean? So I kind of in this no man's land.
Did Dick's fiction function in any way for you years ago, you know, as agency, given his like proclivity for, you know, dark Gnosticism and stuff like that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Not at the time. I mean, I caught on to it when I was reading it at the time. But when I was younger, I was still pretty evangelical, pretty, you know, conservative. It wasn't until I was like in my probably 30s, you know, that I kind of started thinking through some of these things theologically. And then I started noticing after the fact, like after I started kind of pulling on the threads, I started noticing, hey, Phil got there before me. And then I started reading, like, you know, before the exegesis, you know, there were some books out there that included some of his, his writings or some of his letters and things like that, stuff that ended up becoming the published work, The Exegesis. So I'd read some of that, and you know, he did talk about that a little bit, did some interviews where he did talk about some of the Gnostic stuff, and which now I appreciate a whole lot. So like I've been teaching a course on the Gospel of Thomas, and you know, I'm very fascinated by some of the ways that Phil, you know, understood some of that and sometimes misunderstood some of that, but you know, put his own spin on it. And yeah, I think it's really cool, very fascinating. So it's a nice little overlap, I think.
Heath is here to promote. He has a series of Philip K. Dick collections called Sci-Fi Lullabies. And when we get deeper into this interview, we're going to talk about this. But Keith wrote the foreword to the first volume. Tessa Dick is writing the foreword to the second volume. And I'm writing the foreword for the third one. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that we're going to be talking about is that in August, you're starting to teach an online class about the Gospel of PKD. So
you should mention the publisher of the books, too. Who's putting out those
volumes?
That's
Choir Publishing, which, not coincidentally, I am co-owner of Choir Publishing.
Oh, okay, cool.
So it's sort of like, this is sort of a pet project, you know, kind of a dream project. Like, hey, I kind of co-own a publishing company. Wouldn't it be fun to do this? So that's partly why we're doing it.
So you read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Do you remember what were the next couple ones that you read?
Oh yeah, no, I do.
How that evolution happened?
Yes. So the first one was Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and I was just astounded. You know, it was actually better. How, you know, the book was, you know, I always say the book's better than the movie, but it was better because it was, you know, the movie and the book are kind of inversions of each other. They kind of are making the same point, but in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I just really appreciated so much, you know, what was going on in the novel. And then my second one was Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said. Frankly, just because it was the other one on the shelf next to Blade Runner after I went back to the store. I read that one. And then I think I read The Man Who Japed, which I really liked. I don't know, people don't talk about that one very much, but
I love The Man Who Japed. I'm a huge fan of it.
Yeah. So I think for sure those are the first three that I read. And then at some point, I think I came across one of the collected short story things and started jumping into the short stories and really started loving those, you know, as well.
Yeah, Blade Runner was my first. And then my second, and I still have that exact copy. I think it's actually sitting under my computer right now, lifting it up. But the collected stories of Philip K. Dick, Volume 2, with the soon-to-be motion picture Total Recall on it. David Wilson, what were your first two? Do you remember?
So I do, actually. For a second there, I was struggling. And I was going to say, one of my earliest memories is reading Faith of My Fathers. I guess that's a novelette or something. I mean, it's a longer story.
Yeah, but
Dangerous Visions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But then I remember the first time was in I did a master's at UMass Boston, and my mentor assigned me Man in the High Castle. And then from there, I went and did a master's at University of Liverpool in science fiction studies and read everything. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Beginning with Faith of Our Fathers, and then just bought all the books and stories.
Mm-hmm.
And loved it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and you can, everyone can quite publicly follow my journey of reading the publication order here on the podcast, because I had read like five or six of the novels before doing the podcast and then reading them in order, which I will say changes everything when you read them in order.
Really?
That's why I always ask people which order they read them. That's why I wanted to know, Keith.
Oh.
Well, that's cool. So how old were you when you were a teenager when you started reading?
Yeah.
Reading these deeply. Okay.
Yeah. Probably 14, 15, something like that, I think.
Oh, wow.
I think. I'm so bad with math. I'm sure I could do the math and figure it out. But I was a teenager. Yes, that is accurate.
So, and have you lived in Texas like most of your life or?
Yeah, well, about half of my life. I was actually born in a little town in Tennessee. My mom and dad moved to Texas like when I was in second grade. We left for a bit, came back, you know, moved to El Paso when I was in junior high. And then from junior high all the way through college, graduated at UT El Paso, met my wife there. With a degree in creative writing and a minor in philosophy, which is another reason I appreciate Philip K. Dick, because he he's the most philosophical science fiction writer. And yeah, then I moved to California. So I lived in Southern California for 25 years. And then, you know, I had two boys that were born there. And so, yeah. And then now I'm back. I'm back in El Paso. We came back here like about 3.5 years ago.
Wait, you were in Orange County, right? You were in Philland?
I was, yes. And, you know, that was one of the coolest things about it, too. I got to tell a little story. So I lived in Orange, California for the last 11 years. We moved around a little bit in Orange County. It was like Huntington Beach, Tustin, and then we were in Orange for like the last 11 years before we moved. So when I was in Orange, it was really cool. Like you said, it was like Philland because I would drive down Santa Ana, go through Santa Ana, and I would drive by. I had looked it up and I figured out the apartment that he had died in, or that he had a stroke in before he died. I drove by where it was every day on my way to work. So one day on my way back, I kind of drove over, parked, walked around. I think I found the apartment number that he used to be in. So that was cool. And then at the Orange Library, I'm not kidding. This was insane. They had hardback copies of Philip K. Dick. They had a pretty good collection. I would say they probably had like 7 or 8 titles of Philip K. Dick at the Orange Library. At least 2 of them, maybe 3 of them, were signed.
Oh, that's awesome.
Like, I think it was Flow My Tears, a Policeman Said, Now Wait for Last Year, and maybe Time Out of Joint. And they were signed. Phil, you know, signed autograph by Phil. And they were just in circulation. Like, I checked them out. I took them home. I'm reading them. And like, oh, there's his autograph. And I got to say, how many times I thought to myself, how much would it cost me if I just told them I lost the book? Because
you could have just, like, bound one and then just returned it and put the sticker on it. And
yeah, I'll just buy a new one. You know, I replaced the book. Here's $20, right? But, you know, my conscience got the better of me and I couldn't do that. So I actually went to the librarian. After a while, it just bothered me so much. A couple of months went by and I finally just went to the head librarian and I said, hey, I just wanted you to know that you have all these, you know, books by Philip K. Dick. She goes, who? And I said, oh, he's a local sci-fi author. He's dead now. You know, I did the whole thing, Blade Runner, Total Recall, all that stuff. And I said, you have like first edition hardbacks in circulation that are signed by him. And I think you could probably get several thousand dollars if you wanted to raise money for the library, like auction them off on eBay or something.
Yeah, for sure. And
so she acted like, yeah, okay, whatever. Thanks a lot. But like a week later, went back, all those books were gone.
Oh,
right. Boy.
I don't know what happened with him. If someone overheard me and that they lost them, or she just decided, hey, he's right. She looked it up and then they put him in a vault somewhere.
Because it's not as if he, I mean, David, you probably know the answer to this. Did he do a lot of book signings?
No.
I mean, yeah, there's probably a limited number of books that are signed by him.
How many are there? Yeah.
Yeah, there's not a ton. Well, it's like I passed up an opportunity to buy a John Bruner signed Crucible of Time. And I didn't buy it for $25, and it haunts me every time I look at my bookshelf because I passed up that opportunity.
I hate that.
Especially since, you know, he's been dead since the early 90s. It's like, shit. Well, I had a similar experience, Keith, when I went to the Berkeley Library because I decided I was going to try and find the 1947 high school yearbook to find Ursula Le Guin and Phil's like high school.
Oh, yeah.
Yearbook pictures.
Oh, cool.
And I went to the librarian and I said, you know, did you realize that? And then, by the way, Phil's not in the yearbook because he didn't finish out the school year on campus.
Because
he was so sick that he wasn't there for senior pictures. But Ursula Kroeber is. And I went up to the librarian and I said, it's like, this is Ursula Le Guin's senior picture. And she's like, who? And yeah. I was like, and I asked her, do you know who Philip K. Dick and Ursula Le Guin are? And she was like, the librarian at the Berkeley Library was like, nope. And then I was like, no offense, but that's shameful.
Yeah.
And then I went on to explain. And then she was like, yeah, I feel real bad. And then I was like, I'm sure she was just getting me out of there, but she was like, I'm going to educate myself. And I was like, okay, sure.
Mm-hmm.
You got, you were very involved with being a pastor and religion. Of course, your path has changed a little bit, but tell us your story about how you went from It was in Orange County that you kind of had your change of heart or how you saw things about organized religion. So can you tell us that story? Because that's fascinating.
Yeah. I'll try to make it interesting. When I was in El Paso, when I was still in El Paso, the same year I got married, I also got licensed and ordained by the Southern Baptist Church. But I always, but being my degree, my college degree was creative writing and philosophy, right? So I always I would serve at a church on staff in some capacity, youth pastor, associate pastor, whatever. But then I always had like a day job, like my real work, right? But I had like a foot in both sides always growing up and my younger days. And so we ended up in Orange County. We ended up in the Vineyard Movement. And we actually, with some friends of ours, we planted a Vineyard church in Tustin, California, and next door to Irvine, if you don't know where Tustin is. So that was a good experience in general. I mean, we'd never done anything like that before. So a lot of it was positive. But in the course of doing it, we also started working with people that were homeless at the time and really felt like that was something like a good thing. And then right about that time, I came across some research that this guy Ray Mayhew had done that blew my mind. It was like basically going back to the first century Christian church and showing that the number one reason that the Christianity grew in the first like 200 years wasn't persecution. It wasn't miracles. It was their radical caring for the poor, the orphan, the widow, the people that were, on the margins. And so he documented all that. I'm reading all these quotes of early church fathers and stuff. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. We were already doing that kind of work already. And we kind of became convinced like, that's what church should be. So we left, we walked away and we started a little house church group, people meeting in our houses. We didn't have a statement of faith. We didn't have a bank account. We didn't have a 501c3. We didn't, it was basically like, hey, do you love Jesus? And do you want to help people that are, suffering, that are hungry? That every penny that you put in the basket, you will see it being used to buy food or help single mothers pay rent or fix their car or whatever. And we did that. We did that for 11 years and it was amazing. So that was like a big shift. But once we walked away from sort of organized religion that way, then we weren't under an umbrella of any denomination. I didn't have any sort of like spiritual covering over us. It was just like, hey, we feel like this is what we should do. We're going to do it. And we did it. And it was awesome. And we would basically go and have church with the homeless right outside Angel Stadium. There was a huge tent city there for a long time. We would go there and just hang out with them, bring them coffee and donuts and Danishes and socks and batteries, whatever else they needed, and just hang out with them. And it was awesome. So we did that. That was really amazing. And that was kind of where I started looking a little more critically at the theology that I was handed as a young man. Really kind of looking critically at it. And really most of it's looking at early church history, because all the stuff that Christians are told today is, this is it. Like you're handed something where it's like, this is it. And there's nothing else. And then you realize that that's not the case, that again, for like at least the first 400 years on most major church doctrines, there were many differences of opinion on those things. And they all called themselves Christians. It was only much later that they kind of got more and more narrow and decided, oh, you're a heretic and you're a heretic and we're going to, weed you guys out. That kept going till about the 1500s and in a major way, like putting people to death kind of a thing. But anyway, doing the research and stuff, I was kind of like, yeah, things like eternal torment and, the way they look at the cross and all these kind of major doctrines, the second coming, which most people don't know, is a doctrine that started in 1845. The whole right. End times rapture stuff, all that left behind nonsense and late great planet Earth, like that was started by a guy named John Nelson Darby in like 1845. No Christian before that, 1,840 years, no one thought that way. But see, now we think, oh, but that's all there is. It's what the Bible says, but it isn't, right? So once I figured out all that stuff for myself, that radically changed the way I thought about my faith. And then that's when I started writing these books. Like, I'm sure other people would appreciate knowing some of the stuff that I've learned. So I ended up writing this 7-part series, the Jesus Son series.
And that gives you like something that a lot of the people who question Christianity don't have, which is, I'm sure when people come to debate you, they think you're not going to know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And then when you're so knowledgeable, I'm sure that that sets them back a little bit. But yeah, that also makes you very similar in many ways to a person who was a major figure in Phil's life, which is, of course, Bishop Pike. And, you know, for those who don't know, Bishop Pike was the inspiration for Timothy Archer, the character in The Transmigration of Timothy Archer, who was put on trial for heresy as the, excuse me, the Archdiocese of California, and was, you know, a national figure, and then ended up writing a book about seances and, you know, became a really interesting person. Like, what is Phil's relationship with Bishop Pike? Like, is that something that you relate to with him?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely really appreciate, you know, when I read Phil and in this book, Transmigration of Timothy Archer as well, like, getting in more of the metaphysical stuff, the mystical side of the faith. I really appreciate that. And especially, and I know that Phil was fascinated by this too, you know, things like with the Nag Hammadi texts, specifically like the Gospel of Thomas and some of those texts. And it's just like, it's, I mean, for someone who has grown up in the Christian faith, it's this shocking revelation that there are Christianities, plural, for hundreds of years. There's, you know, again, you're basically sold the story that, no, there's just this one Christianity and everybody has always agreed on all of these things. And then when you go back and look and you realize that, no, there's always been about, you know, five or six different kind of brands of Christianity. And, you know, there's just one flavor that happened to have won the day that now gets to rewrite the history. So going back to read some of those things, especially, like I said, the mystical stuff and more of the Gnostic stuff, I resonate with a lot of that. I think a lot of that's really cool.
Well, and I think Bishop Pike was so important for, even though he was long gone by the time we had the Valis and the pink laser beam stuff, the exegesis, I don't think would have been what it was if Bishop Pike hadn't been like a major figure.
Oh, yeah.
Warts and all, because he had a lot of warts.
Yeah, well, right. I think, yeah, I would guess that probably for Phil, you know, he's talking to this guy who is, like, he was a bishop, right, in the Episcopal church. So this is somebody who does know his stuff, you know, when it comes to the Bible and church history and these kind of things. And for Phil to have someone at that level freely talking to him about either some of his doubts or about things that I'm sure he was fascinated with, like, you know, the other ways of thinking of the Christ. The Christ wasn't Jesus' last name, but the Christ was sort of this eternal entity source being, you know, that we know now, like when we talk about like in quantum science, when you see these parallels, right? And I know Phil saw this too. He talks about this a lot too, that there are these overlaps between the way that a lot of early Christian mystics talked about the Christ and the way mystics in general talk about, you know, other words for this kind of source or consciousness. And then the way we have like quantum scientists now talking about the quantum field, right? That there is no separation, that everything is an expression of the one quantum field. It's okay, they call it quantum field. Other people might've called it Christ, but it's still the same sort of ultimate consciousness that permeates everything, you know, that there is. That kind of stuff is super cool. And I can see that all that stuff really sparked some ideas for Phil. And then I'm fascinated by the ways he kind of found interesting ways to put that into his novels.
Do you have a feeling about the exegesis tends to be particularly divisive?
Yeah.
People either love, actually, in my experience, people love it or hate it with very little in between. David, I can't remember your feelings about it. But Keith, what are you? Do you enjoy that?
I think it's pretty unreadable, to be honest.
Okay, yeah.
But see, I like the density of it. I like the Ahab-esque insanity of it. You know.
So no, I think that's it. I think, I love it. I'll say up front.
Yeah, me too.
But the reason I love it, again, it takes a certain kind of person, right? So like, I'll use an analogy. Like when I watch movies, I love movies that have an ambiguous ending. I love that in Inception, they don't show you if the top falls over or not. And I love that.
Yeah.
And all kinds of movies like that, where it fades to black and all your questions aren't answered. And now you want to turn to your neighbor or anybody else who's seen the movie before and have this great conversation about, oh, different theories and ways of thinking about it. And to me, that's what the exegesis is, because Phil didn't know what the hell he was talking about either. The whole thing was him trying to work something out to make sense of something.
Right.
And what's really funny too, is very much like the Bible, Phil contradicts himself, you know. But over here, you said at the beginning you were thinking this way, and like, you know, 10 pages later, you decided you threw that out, and now you're onto another theory, and you're working on something else. But then 10 pages later, you're gonna chuck that, and you're gonna go into another direction. But I like that, because it's I think it's a really beautiful, honest, transparent snapshot of Phil genuinely trying to understand and make sense of, frankly, something that can't be. You know, that kind of transcends language and, mm-hmm. and comprehension, right? What is God? What is Christ? What are these weird experiences he's had? And you see him struggling, like trying to shove different things. Well, maybe it was this, or maybe it was that, or no, it wasn't that, it was this. And I just appreciate that he's doing that.
It's sort of beyond the Thunderdome of the logos, beyond the logos that he...
The logos of the Christ, yes, that's the metaphor.
Yep.
Right. Well, and look, the more I research him and study him, I think next time I go back to the exegesis, I'll be able to detect what was going on with him. So I'll probably be more readable last time I tried to. But and I will tell you, because the religious aspects of what was going on with him is the least interesting part for me. So
see, funny. I love that stuff. I mean, you don't care about that, but I love that. To me, that's my kind of alternate history. Like, and I mean, can I just ask you, like,
sure,
because one of the things I love about Duandro's Dream of Electric Sheep is the sort of the Mercerism. I just wrote a blog post about this about a month ago, going back and looking again at Mercerism. I just think it's so compelling, and it's so because he uses this idea of empathy. I mean, empathy is sort of the main core thing in Mercerism, right, where everybody grabs the handles of the box, the empathy box, whatever. And they're not only are they connected and they can feel what Mercer feels as he's climbing and getting hit by the stones, they also are sharing a consciousness and an empathy with everyone on the planet who at that moment is also holding on, right? So it's this amazing, an epiphany, an awareness of, oh, we are all connected. We are all, you know, through this box, yes, but beyond that, you know, supernaturally, we're all connected. And I just find that so beautiful and so fascinating. That's, to me, that's a great part. And spoiler, hopefully not too much of a spoiler, but I just read The Zap Gun, and I just thought it was genius the way empathy, in a way, is used as a weapon in Zap Gun. I just thought that was a beautiful little twist to the story. So I don't know. I appreciate that kind of stuff. And so find that interesting?
Mercerism
I do
really
find
dynamic.
It interesting. Yeah.
Just
I come at it from animal rights.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Okay.
Yeah. That's my perspective. Professor Wilson?
I was just going to say Mercerism's, I'm with Keith, because Mercerism in particular, which I love, is really dynamic because it pulls from multiple sources. Like there's Buddhism in there, there's Christianity, there's mythology, right? Just the very act of, is it Narcissus who pushes the rock?
Sisyphus is pushing
Sisyphus.
The rock.
Sisyphus.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's an amalgam of Jesus who's suffering, right?
Right.
Whatever, and then suffering is sort of the way, and like Buddha and all that stuff. Yeah.
Well, what? One of the reasons I brought up Acts of Paul, which was really interesting, is that when I kept talking to these experts in Manichaeism, all of them asked me, how did Phil hear about Manichaeism in the early 70s or in the early 80s? Like, because it wasn't like a super common thing.
No,
right?
No, it's not.
Right. And I can't answer that. I don't know where his interest came, but except for, we know that he was really interested in all kinds of Gnostic stuff. And
right.
So what I was, one of the things I was saying is that, well, even though it's the part of Phil that's the least interesting to me, I'm more interested in the writer and all that stuff. I still find it fascinating because it says so much about you know, his search. And I think that the exegesis now, because now I'll be reading the exegesis looking for how things like that happened, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Is there evidence in the exegesis where he talks about, you know, does he reference Manny at some point, and does he do this? So I think it'll read differently for me. But that leads me back to Keith. So let's talk about this class you're teaching and, like, you know, how you're approaching. Is this, I mean, are people gonna, you know, it's funny because when I was first talking to Gil and Dave, we have like a thread going on Facebook where we just like constantly are talking about PKD, and Gil and I had this hilarious interaction because I said, I'm working on Acts of Paul. And he said, because a lot of the beliefs of Manny is the light and dark side, he said, is it totally Star Wars?
Oh, wow.
And I laughed and I said, yeah, but Gnostic as fuck. And we just kind of laughed about it. And this whole, not like his, not Phil's knowledge of Gnosticism is probably the backbone of your class, right? Of what you're doing. Is it using Phil as a way to teach what the Gnostics were doing? Is
a
my
little
question.
Bit. Yeah. It's I mean, I hope it's a little bit of all of it. You know what I mean? It's not like, I'm not using Phil as an excuse to talk about those things. It really is like, let's talk about Philip K. Dick and his life and his background and, you know, all this amazing stuff that he went through, and the pink laser beam, and, you know, having this epiphany that his son needed an emergency surgery, and all that kind of stuff, which I think is so great. And the break into his house and all that stuff. But I mean, I'm also, yeah, I'm looking at, in the class, I mean, so what this is, the online class I'm doing in August, the Gospel of Philip K. Dick, I taught a course at UTEP here, UT El Paso. And what I did was I just kind of like covered the novels. It was more like literary stuff. So it was like, you know, we looked at Drano's Dream of Electric Sheep. We looked at Valis. We looked at Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said. I think those are the three main ones I looked at. And I just, you know, I went through the novel and the story and the plot and the themes. But when I came to some of these themes, I would connect them to other ideas, and I would connect them to, you know, Phil's obsession with, like, you know, we all know Philip K. Dick's big things were constantly questioning what is real and how do I know, and what does it mean to be human and how do I know, right? So all those kind of like paranoid, self-reflective kind of things that he does, which are very philosophical. When I come to those points in the novel, I will stop and talk about those a little bit more in depth. And then I will, you know, pull in maybe some quotes from the exegesis, or pull in things like quantum science kind of stuff, where I've just read some really fascinating books by some quantum scientists where they end up sounding a little bit like Philip K. Dick, or they end up sounding like some kind of a mystic, you know. And I just find all that's the overlap to all those things to me is really fascinating. So I guess there's layers to all of that. You're going to get all of that when you take the class. It's mainly going to be, let's look at Philip K. Dick. Let's look at his novels, some of the major novels. But we're also then going to look at all these themes of questioning, how do I know what's real? Can I trust my memory? Can I trust what I see in front of me? Can I trust my eyes and ears and my experiences? And what is it that makes me human? Right. And which I also love, again, this gets back to the empathy question. You know, what makes someone human is that they have an empathy for other people, for animals, and they're capable of that, and they express that. And so, yeah, so that I cover all those kind of things in the class.
Keith, is it's online, right?
It will be online. Yes. Yeah. So I do a lot of online classes. Uh-huh. Mostly the classes that I've done to this point are based on my books. So like every one of the Jesus Sun series has a corresponding class. And it's like, awesome. Always like a 3-week class. It's like $19.99. It's just sort of like I walk you through the book, and I always try to go deeper. When I'm researching a book, I always I make little playlists. Like I'll make a YouTube playlist of like interviews, debates, TED Talks, you know, interesting documentaries, whatever. I'll just put all this stuff that's related to the different things I'm going to cover in that book. And so when I do the course, it's really great because then I can do my lecture on that chapter, but then I can say, hey, here's a clip, watch this, or, you know, check this out. And I can add more extra material. I can really expand the topic a lot more than just what's in the book. So that's what I've done on my Jesus On books. I did one for the Gospel of Thomas. So there's a class on the Gospel of Thomas that's already up there now. And so, yeah, for Philip K. Dick, that's what it'll be too. It'll be online. It'll be like 3 weeks. Yeah, it'll be like a 3 week course again. It'll be $19.99, same kind of thing. And it'll probably be more self-paced so that, you know, people can watch as many as they want. They can go as fast as they want. They can go as slow as they want. They can go back and watch something again. Like once you register, you'll always have access. It won't expire. It doesn't go away. And hopefully, you know, it's like a really good overview. Like, as I said, it fills his better novels and exploring those main themes that he deals with.
It is because I teach a lot of online classes that are not all of them, but text-based with other stuff thrown in there. But I don't have a lot of, like, it's called IBDL where I am, wherein, you know, there's a screen and I can see the students and we can actually directly interact.
Yes.
Is there that? Or yeah.
Yeah. So no, there isn't. I do have some.
I actually don't like that much.
Yeah. I want to say, yeah.
Always glitching and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So, all of my book courses that I've done and the Thomas course that I've done and this course will be sort of pre-recorded videos for each individual, you know, daily lecture on whatever topic I'm covering. Right. But now some of my classes I have done, I've got a longer, it's like a course in community I do called Square One, and that runs for like 3 months. And there are weekly lectures, and then there's a live Zoom call that I do with everybody. I just kind of walk them through that whole 3 month, you know, course. And so that's a lot more intensive and all that. And I love doing it because I do get to help people process some of these kind of like toxic theologies that they're kind of coming out of and figure out what for themselves. I don't tell them because I don't know, but I try to help them figure out what for them makes sense moving forward. Sure. So that's what I've been doing in Square One, but it does involve this sort of live Zoom thing, which I love and hate because it, like, I've been doing it now for like 4 years and I don't have weekends. Like my Saturdays are, I'm on a Zoom. I'm with a bunch of people on a Zoom call and I'm walking through and I have a Square One, I have a Square Two, and there's a Square Three that runs on Sunday. So, because of that, when I do these kind of classes, like, I'm not going to include a Zoom element because it's like I'm already Zooming way too much.
Understood. All right. Anything else you want to say about the class before we move on to the collection?
No, that's good. I mean, it's just it'll start August 7th, and it'll be self-paced. So, like I said, you can anytime you register it, you know, you can, it'll be there for you. You can take it, go as fast or slow as you want.
So one more question. Just to clarify for listeners or viewers. So the class you're talking about, the PKD class, is not through UT El Paso. It's just anybody can take it, right?
Thank you. Yeah, that's right. No, it's not affiliated with anything. Like I just have a Podia website, which is, you can buy a subscription to something like Podia, or Kajabi is another one. And it allows you to record stuff and sell courses. So yeah, that it's all based on my own Podia platform, and it'll be hosted there, and it's not affiliated with the university or anything like that.
Cool.
Very cool. All right. So Sci-Fi Lullabies Volume 1.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me about selecting the stories for the first volume. Like what was your thinking for putting these stories together? Maybe we should go through them. Beyond Lies the Wub, which is an obvious very early story.
Yeah.
The Gun, right? The Skull, The Defenders, which was a early precursor of The Penultimate Truth, of course.
Right.
Mr. Spaceship, Piper in the Woods, Second Variety, which I consider to be Phil's second best masterpiece of any kind. And then The Eyes Have. So
I'm curious, though, what do you think? What'd you say is the first masterpiece?
Three Stigmata.
Oh, wow. Okay. Very cool. Yeah. So there wasn't a whole lot of like the only thought around it was like, I liked how the stories, most of the stories in volume one, the ones you just read, they all have a very strong kind of like anti-war story. And not all of them, but like there's several of them in there that are very much sort of like exposing the stupidity of war as, you know, it's just a bad idea. It's probably one of humanity's worst ideas ever. Like, we have a disagreement, so why don't we just send our children out to kill each other until one of us says uncle? Yeah, maybe there's a better way to solve that, right? So anyway, I just love, and I love the way Phil approaches that topic. So I tried to group those together a little bit. And I did put, I also tried, again, there's three volumes. And what I also tried to do was put some lesser known earlier ones together, but also with some of the ones that I feel like are some of his better short stories too. So there was always be like one or two, they're like, hey, these are great stories. These are like A level. And then there'd be some other ones in there that I think are really good, but may not be as well known as some other stories. So in this volume one, you know, Second Variety is one of the big ones there. Yeah. And, you know, and I try
I
to
don't
do
know what's in volume two, but I have read all the stories in volume three, obviously, because I'm
yes
about to do the foreword. And in volume three, I think the two real standout stories are the Turning Wheel and the Unreconstructed M.
Yes, which that one's one of my favorites. When I read Unreconstructed M, it was one of those things where I read it and I feel like there are certain things that Phil wrote that when I'm reading it, I feel like, oh my gosh, man, this is like, this could have been written yesterday. Like this could be, I could see this on a Netflix, you know, series or on a film right now. It was like, it's the way it's thought out. There's just really just there's something about it that makes it stand out from some of his other stories. And I love that story so much. And the other weird effect I had like that was not the whole thing, but the first chapter of Counterclock World, the way it's written, where the policeman, you know, it goes to the graveyard and he calls everybody and they're digging the body out and all that stuff. Like that whole scene, I could see that whole scene in my head. Like this is the opening to like a really cool sci-fi horror film. But and then I read then, chapter two and blew that up.
Yeah. Hey,
was it difficult to secure copyright?
No. So this is the thing. They're all public domain.
They are?
Yes. Oh,
how?
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be like 100 years or 80 years.
No. So there basically, I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but what I've come across, I think in the '50s at some point, is that right? Maybe not. Maybe it was like later. I want to say maybe in the '70s. There was some point where, if the copyright holders would renew the copyright, it would be extended for another, I don't know, 50 years or something. And the estate at the time, I guess they did, you know, they got all the novels, and they got most of his short stories. But he wrote 120 something short stories.
Yeah.
So they didn't get them all. And so there's like, I think 30 or 40 short stories that are either public domain or at least are in the iffy category of like, no one really knows. Because there was, I did come across someone had researched this where even the paperwork that was turned in, a lot of it was wrong. So because you had to list the original copyright date and the original publication, like, this was in fantasy and science fiction, you know, volume blah, 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 19, whatever. And like about 10 of them were just completely off or made up or just wrong. So because of that, they lapsed as well. So, and now there's a story behind that whole thing with the copyright too.
With adjustment team, are you getting
the
to
adjustment
that?
Team? Yes.
Yeah. I was about to mention that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a famous lawsuit. I think this is partly how this came up, that there was, oh, by the way, there's a whole lot of Philip K. Dick stuff in the public domain. When they were making Adjustment Bureau, right, with Matt Damon, whatever the studio was, that so they went to the estate and, you know, Issa Dick and those people, and they said, you know, we want to make this movie. And they gave him like $1 million or something for the rights to make the film. And they're about halfway through finished filming the movie when someone realizes, oh, hey, by the way, this is public domain. And so then they're kind of like, oh, hey, you know what? We'd like that money back, because we paid you for rights to something that we didn't need to because it's public domain. And it went to court and there was a big thing. And I think as a result of that court case, it sort of came out that story was public domain, and that therefore a whole lot of other ones were as well.
Yeah, that's how it, if the adjustment team thing hadn't happened, we wouldn't know how many
Probably
had
not.
fallen into public domain. And
Now,
part of
the
it
other,
is
go
that
ahead.
Paul Williams was the executor for the estate, but when he died, the family took over, but Paul Williams knew what he was doing as
Yeah.
executor of the estate. But, and it's not to say that he said she's been a really great advocate as a
Oh yeah.
producer,
Oh yeah.
but some of the stuff, and personally, my feeling, the one thing I wish they would do differently with the literary stuff is the Mariner editions are the boringest, worst covers. And what I really wish they would do is all new paperback editions with new introductions,
Yeah.
new covers, give people a reason to buy new editions because, you know, with academic supplements and bonus
Yeah. Oh,
features,
yeah.
like they could
Yeah.
do so much with those novels if they reprinted them right.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, like, and it does Mariner editions. I mean, I have a lot of them because I don't mind marking them up. Because my versions are all like highlighted to hell
Oh wow. No,
and
I don't.
everything.
Well, yeah, you're doing research, I guess.
Yeah, well, I guess I reached over and pulled out my Man in the High Castle. You can see
Oh
like
yeah.
just
Wait,
random
let me see
page.
that. Let me see the cover of that.
Yeah, what's the
That
cover? Oh
it's
yeah, this
just
the hate cover.
red. I can't believe what
How
Mariner
boring
did
is
to
that?
those.
That's so
Yeah,
boring.
it's so, I mean, of all, like, especially when like the Berkeley paperback had that amazing cover with all like the swastikas and, you
Yeah.
know, and all that. And it's, you know,
But I
I.
like those old I mean, we were talking about this in the last episode, those vintage covers. They're crazy, but there's something appealing about them. Keith, your cover is really, I really like it. It's very
Thank you.
it's dynamic, but it's professional looking too.
Yes.
And
Yeah. So the
sleek
yeah.
and, you know.
Thank you. Yeah. So that's that again. Sort of our vision. I'll just do a little bit of backstory. So Choir. I became myself and my friend Matthew DeStefano. Choir Publishing has been around for like 7 years or so, and so they were my publisher, and I was just being published by them. So that whole 7-part series I did, I was just an author with them. But the guy that started the company. Reached a point where like this was sort of he started on the side and it had grown to the point where it was just too big and he has another job that's providing very well for his family and he's a designer so he designs all the covers for all the choir books and he's fantastic
Yeah, it's pretty
so
cool.
he stuck around so he's still doing covers for us so we're very grateful for that but anyway we Matthew and I took over the company in January so when we did that's when we started making some changes to the company. And one of the things we wanted to do was this, what we called the Choir Classic series. And that was going originally, it was just like finding public domain books. So things like The Prophet by Khalil Gibran or Alice in Wonderland, right, by Lewis Carroll or Call of the Wild by Jack London, or just like finding these books that are in public domain and putting some great covers on them and getting interesting people to write forewords. Right. So there's some new material that we're adding to this book. Because they're out there. It's not like, oh, you can't get a copy. You can get all kinds of copies. They're all over the place. But we wanted to create something that was like hopefully going to help these novels initially find a new audience. Right. And so we already have launched that and that's done really well. And so because we were already in this mode of looking for things that are in public domain that we thought we could really find someone, we could match somebody to do a forward who would already has a following has the bring readers to this to these books we're already doing that successfully. It just sort of dawned on me like well if you go to Gutenberg which is there's a Gutenberg is where all of these public domain books and stories are kind of cataloged and you can do a search so if you search Philip K. Dick you will a whole bunch of short stories come up and then it's like oh well then they're in public domain. And so then I started looking through them and like, all right, I'm a huge Philip K. Dick fan. I'm definitely writing the foreword to volume one, but there's enough stories here that we could do volume two and volume three and maybe even volume four. So let's do it, right? So let's get a great cover. Let's write
I
a great
want to write the
foreword.
one for volume four,
All right.
please.
If we do a volume four, you're on, man. You're on.
Thank you.
So yeah, so that was where the idea came from. And so far it's been great. Like, we've gotten great feedback from people. And again, like it's also again, like I'm not gonna act like you can't find these short stories. I mean, they're published everywhere. But again, we're just trying to reintroduce it, sort of relaunch it, and hopefully help some people find and discover Philip K. Dick's work that, you know, they're in that group of people that are like, who's Philip K. Dick?
Like, right. Yeah, and well, I got to say, know. Like, this is a good collection of stories. You've given a good reason why they're bound together. I can only speak to volume one and three because I haven't seen two yet. Three, another great story that's in there, The Turning Wheel, yeah, is one of my favorites, which, of course, you know, shots fired at L. Ron Hubbard back in the 50s by PKD hit in that story. And, you know, I can just tell you that my personal feeling, like, in writing the foreword is that my idea is, like, I want to give people a reason enough to get the book, like, that there's going to be enough flavor and vibe that I can add to it, you know. And it's one of the nice things that you've done with the foreword of your book, of your volume. So, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And also, this one has Second Variety in it.
Yes. So, that's right. Well, I will give you a tease. The one, the volume two, that Tessa is writing the foreword to, the bigger ones in that are The Golden Man and The Variable Man. That those are both, because those are, come on, those are huge stories. Some of, you know, those well-known stories. What The Golden Man was made into, that horrible.
I can't believe those are public domain.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. When I look them up, I'm like, are you kidding me? I can't believe that these got overlooked. I mean, I would understand if something like the Skull, or, you know what I mean, some of these, like, yeah, it's okay. But to let something lapse that is such iconic, when you think of Philip K. Dick, The Variable Man, The Golden Man, like Second Variety, Unreconstructed M, like, I can't believe that these got left behind, but they did.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of these
Escape
authors
tend to be pretty possessive, right?
Oh yeah, if these were not public domain, I'm sure I'd have a cease and desist already.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because, I think the estate and the family was pretty upset with how it turned out, but there's not much they can do about it now.
Yeah, sadly, yeah, it's yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. So in this collection of the first couple stories, we I don't know. Is there anything else you want to say about? Because this one's available now, right?
People. Yes, this one's out now.
Yeah.
Yep. It's on Kindle and it's on, it's in paperback. It's available on, on Amazon. And yeah, it's, you know, and again, we put a lot of work into it. You know, if you look through, it's kind of hard to see on the video, but, you know, we put these cool little, like, you know, separators in here, like little Saturns and things like that. We just tried to make it something really special, and rather than just slapping it together and, try to go through them. I think, yeah, putting it together was a lot of fun. And then, you know, hearing people who have been reading it and discovering Philip K. Dick. I mean, my mom was starting to read it, and I don't know that my mom would ever have read them if it wasn't like, oh, my son put these together, right?
Right. Well, yeah. Well, it's funny because as somebody who likes recovered science fiction, you know, the fact that the public domain's out there, that, you know, that some of these authors, like, you know, we have the ability to put them back in print just because,
yes,
you know, nobody else is doing it. So you might as well, like, you know, recover some of these authors. That Phil needs to be recovered. He doesn't need to be recovered, but at the same time, it's fun.
Right.
So,
yeah. Well, I know the thing that's also been cool too about this, like, in general, about this Quark Classic series, like, you know, when we did Khalil Gibran's The Prophet, again, that book is not out of print. I mean, it's in public domain, but I mean, you can find, there's lots and lots of versions of that. But when we put out our version with a new cover and a new foreword, Paul Young, the guy that wrote The Shack, wrote the foreword to that. And that, in that book, The Prophet, Khalil Gibran's book, went to number one for like 2 weeks. And like, that was awesome. It was really cool to be able to say, hey, we put Khalil Gibran's book back in number one on Amazon. Like, that's really cool. Because, you know what I mean? Like, it's otherwise, I mean, yes, there, but you got to look for it. You got to be, people that already know about it, this is like an opportunity for people to discover something. And I know a lot of people that came to me and said, like, I never even heard of this book, but I'm going to give it a shot because, you know, the people that are involved with it, that choir's, you know, putting it out, that Paul Young wrote the foreword, has a great cover. Like, yeah, why not? I'm going to read it for the first time. And that's what's kind of cool about it. I think also, just real quick, when it comes to, we see a lot of people today, unfortunately, coming from sort of a religious background, and what they're trying to do is ban books and, you know, get rid of books. So we're excited to like resurrect some books and put things back in print and keep things out there. That's kind of our vision.
Good.
Yeah. No, it's cool. I think it's a cool project. I think it's good to, because here's the thing, you know, right now the estate's putting out books with covers like this.
Yeah.
So no offense, because they're doing, I know they've got higher priorities.
Sure.
The estate's priorities are keeping him in production, and they're doing a great job with that.
Yes, and I'm glad they are. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are there currently two volumes out now?
No. Volume one is only out now. Volume two with Tessa Dick, her forward's already written. So we just got to put it together. It'll probably be out, I'd say, before Christmas, sometime before the end of the year. And then volume three with David's forward will be out for like first quarter of next year.
Okay. Yeah. Anything else, Keith, that you want to tell the dickheads out there?
Well, I guess the one thing I will say too is that Choir is kind of going all in on sci-fi right now. So we are currently collecting chapters for your short story anthology we're doing. So this is new. We already have probably about half of the book completed, and we've got some really interesting short stories. David, you sent me one, which we're going to use. Claudia Christian, who was on Babylon 5, she sent me one with her co-author. And that one's really good. We're going to use that. Tessa Dick sent me one that's a new story she sent me. We're going to use that one. So, and a bunch of other people that are, some that are published authors, some that are not. So that's cool. That's an anthology we're hoping to put out pretty soon. We're also doing new science fiction as well. So I got to pitch this book. The book is called The Person on the Other Side of This Book. And it's a brand new author. His name is Samuel Tanner. And it's sort of this beautiful blending of like Kurt Vonnegut and Philip K. Dick. It's got Vonnegut's kind of like writing style, kind of like snarky, you know, first person, kind of funny, but dark humor. But it's got Philip K. Dick's thing also, where he's kind of going very philosophical and kind of what is this real or not? And it's really great. It's a really great novel. And that's what Choir just put that out. That's been out for about a month. And we have another author, his name is Brandon Andrus. And he has a really great book called What Can't Be Hidden. And his follow-up book, And So By Fire, will be out in about another month or two. So we're doing, we're publishing science fiction. And whether it's Philip K. Dick, you know, his short stories, whether it's anthologies, whether it's new authors, we want to establish Choir as being a science fiction publisher, that we're interested in publishing stuff like that.
I think you're doing really fun and exciting stuff. So, Keith, I will be seeing you for dinner in San Diego soon. So next we talk shall be over Thai food.
For the Comic-Con. Yeah. The little Philip K. Dick panel.
All right. Oh, wow.
Yeah. That'll be fun.
And, so I will be seeing you soon, but tell the folks how they can find all your work. Where are the best places to do that?
Yeah. Thank you. So if you just go to my name, keithgiles.com, KEITHGILES.com, that'll take you to my Pathos blog. And I blog there pretty regularly. I also do every Friday I publish, it's called The Inner Circle. It's basically a weekly commentary on one of the sayings from the Gospel of Thomas. And so all that's at keithgiles.com. You can find that. All my books are on Amazon. You can find them there. I'm on social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, even on YouTube and all that stuff. And I also do some podcasting. So I have my solo podcast is called Second Cup with Keith. And you can find that anywhere you find a podcast. I also do Apostates Anonymous with my friend Matt, who also is co-owner of Choir Publishing with me. That's just a lot of fun. We love making up fake sponsors for our podcast. So every episode is a fake commercial for a sponsor. It's hilarious. And I do another one that I've been doing now for about 7 or 8 years called Heretic Happy Hour. And I'm a co-host of that with like three other people. So that's also a lot of fun.
Cool. Well, so, you know, this episode was sponsored by Looney Luke's Jalopy, Mars Jalopies. So if you need a Mars Jalopy, Looney Luke's. Yeah, it was great having you here. You know, I've been meaning to have you on Dickheads for a long time. We were waiting for the right project to promote. But we've been chatting for a bit. And it's nice to virtually meet you in person. Professor Wilson, do you have any other questions or anything else you want to ask?
I don't. It was nice to meet you, Keith. Hopefully,
yeah, nice to meet you guys.
Talking and seeing you again.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on that note, as always, we always sign off by reminding everyone to keep it paranoid. Stay paranoid. Later, dickheads.